Howdy, y'all. You're listening to the Managing Up Show. I am Travis Weisgood, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Brandon Hayes and Nick Means.
Hello there.
Howdy. So earlier this week, a good friend of mine messaged me some topic ideas for us on Twitter, and there's one of them that I'm particularly fascinated by. I'm just going to read what Amy Unger wrote to me. It is, walking into a new-to-you-but-established team, whether you were hired into a job or you got a team as part of a reorg, how do you approach coming into an established dynamic as a person of formal authority, but little knowledge or informal influence? And I was fascinated by this. This is something that we'll all do several times over the course of our career as engineering managers, because statistically speaking, in 18 months, we're going to change jobs. Not saying that the three of us are, but the average tenure for an engineer in our industry is 18 months. So we're going to do this a lot. We should talk about how to do it well.
And even if you stay in your job, you're going to get reorged. That's an absolute fact of life. There is essentially zero chance that you maintain a steady state as a manager in your team for 2+ years. So this is absolutely statistically, if you manage for longer than that, you're going to encounter this periodically. So, and it's an extremely well-worded question.
Yeah, I love the way she worded it. Walking into an established dynamic as a person of formal authority, but with little knowledge or informal influence. Because that is the nut of the problem right there.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've all done it poorly enough that we kind of have an idea of what we don't do at this point. Maybe we should talk about that first.
Yes, let's talk about the bad stuff. Let's talk about the mistakes. I can start on that one.
You're a little too eager there.
I have frequent conversations with somebody I used to manage at one of these teams. And so we don't get to stray very far in our conversations without recentering on the topic of stuff that I've learned since then. And one of the things I definitely learned is there's a tendency for people of not a ton of experience in this role to come in and treat it like a mid-level developer treats major technological challenges in a code base. And that is, this code base is really hard to work in. You know what wouldn't be really hard to work in? A completely new code base that I wrote from scratch. You have the capability to build something from whole cloth, but you haven't yet been tested on how you can take something over and maintain it and improve it gradually over time. And that applies to managers, I think, as much as individual contributors. And so I walked in as that contributor with some management experience, and management experience where I got to build and choose all the people on my team. And I thought, if I could just choose all the people on my team and set the vision myself and bring those people along, then I know exactly how to manage the team. And it turned out that was not the right way to manage this existing team. And trying to use the skills that I learned running a team that I built from scratch to try to manage a team that I inherited was a very poor fit.
So one of the things you mentioned there was talking about the trying to apply the worldview that had worked for you in the past to this new world that you were presented with. And I remember as a budding programmer, as I started to expand out my understanding of different languages, I had a really hard time trying to build that mental scaffolding from one language and one paradigm to another. For me, it took doing it enough to start to see the patterns that arose that weren't just me bridging some prior knowledge and making the connections. You do it the first time. If in your next job you're managing teams again, you were somewhat successful. So you've gotten the opportunity to do it again. And now you've got to like figure out how do I translate what I know that worked prior to this new world that I have in front of me? Well, I knew I had this person on the team, and I knew I had this type of contributor, and we had these ceremonies as a team and all of this work. So let me try to kind of brute force my way through it. And if you're lucky, you're able to figure out some sort of equilibrium there that works and balances that. But if you try to do that again to the next team that you join, it's going to be even harder.
And I think there's a couple of things that as someone younger in my management career that I was especially susceptible to that make this problem worse. One of them is that the rate of change that you're used to being able to affect in a code base as an engineer does not equate with the rate of change that you're able to affect as an engineering manager. Change is so much slower as a manager. And you couple that with the fact that you're emerging into your first management role and you feel tons of pressure to prove that you're a manager, to prove that you belong in this role, that you try to change a lot of stuff really fast, way faster than it should be changed.
I think there's something there in the speed of change as well. when you're looking at the team in the abstract from the point of view of a manager and thinking of all of the pieces as they fit together, moving this here, moving that there, for all of us coming from a coding background, we're like, oh yeah, well, let's just refactor the team. And we have all of this built-in context while we're thinking about it. And we're like, okay, here's what we're going to do. And the team is like, whoa, what? And it completely shocks them because they've lost all of that. The context hasn't translated in the same way that it did for you. So that's something I've found that I've have to do is slow myself down to be more gradual and not be that, okay, we're just going to completely rip out this module and replace it with this other thing. Applying that same logic that you could totally do in an afternoon in a code base, you're not going to do that in even weeks, really, on a team. This is something that slowly you're going to evolve towards over weeks, months, sometimes even years.
That is a giant problem space in engineering management, too. We should do a whole episode sometime on the pitfalls of treating your team like a code base.
Ooh, yeah. It is an apt metaphor in a lot of ways. Even if you're not treating your team like a code base, assuming that culture change is going to happen quickly. I read a tweet, and I wish I could find it to attribute whoever wrote it, but it said something to the effect of, people think culture change is a reasonable thing to do, but think about how hard it is to change a person, and now you have to change a whole bunch of them. That's what culture change is. Like, oh yeah, that does sound really hard. Yeah, no kidding.
Not only do you have to change the individual people, you have to change the patterns by which they work together, which is a whole other meta level problem.
Mm-hmm. And I want to table some of this for a minute because there are basically two things to talk about. And one of them was Amy's original question about how do you come in without influence and start just becoming successful in general? Who knows what success looks like? But I think we all know, and it's funny that we all jump to the same conclusion, the change is a requirement. And I want to come back to why that is later in the episode. But for now, let's assume that things are sort of at least stable, if nothing else. That you get brought into a team through some reorg or some change, like maybe a manager left and you're coming to backfill a position or one of the gentler introductions into a team, which, as we all know, is not actually typical. If that's how you came into management, congratulations. You got the you get to enter into the shallow end first. I want to talk about that for a minute and talk about patterns for success in taking over a team.
Well, to take it back to the code metaphor, I think one of our temptations when we get into a code base that's a little bit on the rocky side is to immediately start judging the people that wrote that code.
Mm-hmm.
And the same can be true of entering into a new engineering team as a manager. Your brain immediately goes to, how did this group of people end up in the room together trying to write code? And I think that's a super dangerous pattern. So one of the things that I think is really important in this situation is to have sort of empathy and compassion and realize that these people came together for a reason, and it's not just random. Somebody picked them all to be on this team. And sometimes you have to give it a minute to figure out why that is and figure out the ways that they do work well together. Because there's something there. Even if you walk into a team that you think is pretty rocky, there's some good patterns that you can find.
It's interesting you talk about kind of giving it a minute and letting it settle. I've walked into teams before where I've taken that approach very consciously and fought against the urge to say, well, what if we did this? Even though 2-3 months down the road, once I had built up a better understanding of the team, I ended up still saying, well, what if we did this? I recently left a role. And as I was talking to the people who were around me and saying, like, tell me about your experience with me. Like, what could I have done differently? What could I have done better? Some of the feedback I got was the early time in that particular role, I was seen as kind of standoffish. Because I wasn't as engaged as I got later in my time there, because I was trying to take that role of like observer and see how things played out rather than come in both barrels blazing with, okay, we're going to change this and that and this, and we're reorging the teams like this. So there's a potential downside to coming in and not having that opinion. You are being brought into a team generally because people believe in the value that you can bring to this team. So not being afraid of owning that to some extent. And I think the place where that can go too far is when it is with the like, okay, well, yeah, this is great. I love that this is a whole web project written in Ruby, but Django's much better. We're going to rewrite this in Django. Like taking that sort of programmer approach to your team where it's like, oh yeah, this is great. I'm sure you all were hired for great reasons, but we're going to change everything about the world that you know. That's the almost farcical. And I say almost farcical because we're all grinning here. I think we've all witnessed this at some point or maybe partaken a little bit more closely than we intended to. So the thing I found I have to watch out for is if I resist having an opinion too much, you can be seen as this one person put it, standoffish. If you don't come in with the opinions that you were hired to bring to the team. And if you have that tendency to want to come in and just, here, I'm going to change everything about this team. If that's a tendency that you're afraid of doing, whether it's your personality type or you've witnessed that firsthand and seen how badly that can go when it's taken to its extreme, you have to kind of balance not pulling back too much.
So another semi-risk by following this approach, and I'm going to take this one kind of to the next level, because a pattern I've seen that I like and is successful and I think I will replicate in the future in a transition of management or leadership is becoming aggressively inquisitive. Tell me about this. What's going on here? Why is that like this? What's going on with this code? What are the challenges that you guys are facing? What's going on with that? And just being observational and inquisitive, almost to the point of being irritating about it. I actually really like this because I've seen this be successful. For a person of my personality type, though, the challenge and danger in that is when I come into a new role, it can be difficult to not become overwhelmed because people will bring you their problems and they will tell you what they don't like about their job immediately. And oftentimes they will tell you that they don't like that you're here. They like the way things were before, thank you very much. Or they don't like anything about the way things were and it's your job to change everything. And it's easy to find yourself overwhelmed with the volume of problems that you unearth in this discovery phase. But I think we can kind of all agree, step one is a discovery phase of some kind.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it's sitting back and watching and observing the patterns of the team and the way they work, or it's the inquisitive approach, or it's roundtable where you're sitting people down and going, okay, what do you not like about working here in sort of a public setting so that they have to temper their answers somewhat? There's several different ways to do this, but I think you're exactly right. That is step one. You have to discover the patterns of the team.
So I found a borderline secret weapon. I say borderline secret weapon because if you've read The Coaching Habit, you've come across this. A tool in response to the everything sucks, I need you to change everything. Okay, the team doesn't do this, the team doesn't do that, or the team does this thing that really annoys me. Okay, well, how would you like me to handle that? And ask the person to have some idea of how they would approach it. Like, how would you like me to help you solve this problem? And I've had a lot of situations where I've asked that question, where the one-on-one has turned into 5, 10, 15 minutes of this is horrible, this is horrible, this is horrible, this is horrible. And okay, that's great. How would you like me to help? Like, I'm happy to get really involved. I'm happy to be the person listening to you rant. I'm happy to find something else that I haven't even thought of that's a way that I could help you. But how would you like me to help you through this situation? And that causes everybody to sort of pause for a minute and go, oh, okay, yeah, no, that's a good question. What am I expecting out of this conversation? I think a lot of times, especially if you're coming into a team where people are frustrated or there's been some frustration, it's really easy. Oh, I've got somebody who's asking me what all my problems are. I'm going to talk to this person. I have months or maybe more of anguish built up and things that I see that are wrong. And I just need to vent and get that out. And the second you're like, okay, now let's turn this into something practical. It comes back into a place that's much more, to use a very managery word, actionable, rather than just, here's all the things that are wrong.
And what's funny about that is I use that same tool in one-on-one sometimes when somebody is in sort of event mode. And inevitably you ask them, do you want my action? Do you want my advice? Or do you just need to get this off your chest? About 80% of the time, it's the third one. It's, I just needed to get this off my chest. I feel much better now talking it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how often that's the case.
Yeah, that's been my experience too.
One other thing before we dive into the fun stuff, which is taking over a team that has issues. Practically speaking, nobody likes getting a new manager. This sucks for every single person that when you're taking over, whether you've just been hired, the context reset that occurs, people are going to have logistical questions. Look, I was due for a raise soon. What are you going to do about that? Does my clock reset now on becoming a senior developer because I was making a lot of progress? Are you going to evaluate me the way that the other person was evaluating me? Because that person told me I was really close. And these are things they may be too polite to even ask about, and they'll just sit there and be upset. And so you're kind of starting at a disadvantage, not kind of, you are starting at a disadvantage because the context change of switching out your manager, even if, let's say you're the best manager in the world and the team should be excited that you're there. They don't know you yet. And all they know is that you're the devil they don't know. And so there's a little bit of extra care to take in the discovery phase about how things were working for them. Hey, what was going well? What are you worried about losing in this transition? And so the discovery phase per person really does need to take a lot of that into account.
Well, and hopefully you have the chance to talk to the person who was previously managing this team, if it's somebody that's just changed roles and still in the organization, because you can get a lot of that information from the previous manager. And the other thing I would say is if you find yourself in a position where you are hiring a manager for the team, if you can give that team the chance to interview the manager before they come in and take over the role, that does so much for a new manager coming into a team to have just that tiny bit of buy-in already before they even walk in the door. It makes those initial conversations so much easier. I've gotten to do that on a couple of teams, and it's coming into a team, having interviewed with most of the members of the team, it's so much easier from my perspective.
Yeah, I think that's all like good, happy path stuff.
Yeah.
And then...
So what do we do when we walk into a team that is not performing, that is struggling to ship software, that has personality conflicts? Because you walk in with formal authority, but no informal influence, to quote the question again. And you don't have a whole lot of knowledge about the dysfunction other than somebody telling you, oh yeah, this team's not doing too well. Welcome. What's different when you approach a team like that versus one that is functioning pretty well?
I think one of the first things you have to do is figure out what is not functioning, because you mentioned a couple of things there. There's a big difference between a team that can get software out the door but has a bunch of personality conflicts and a team that gets along great but doesn't get software out the door. So trying to figure out exactly what situation you're walking into. And this comes back to sort of the discovery phase. That's going to be part of it. Yeah, sometimes you're going to walk into a team and have no idea what the state of the team is until you actually get in the building. So teasing those apart, hopefully you're in a situation where you don't have all of those things going. If you have all of those things, then it becomes a test of prioritization and figure out, okay, what's the most important thing for this team?
When you talk about that, I'm like, I've seen the full menu.
So how have you tackled it in the past, Brandon?
Horribly, and then better, hopefully.
And then less horribly.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, my prior examples of what not to do around coming in and taking a team over and trying to kind of lean on whatever your superpowers are and just be a superhero is just the wrong answer. And I thought, oh, you know what my superpowers are? I'm into vision and I'm into people getting on board with that vision and bringing people onto the team that share my values and can help me see that through. And I thought those three things, that turned out to be really great when I was a company founder. And those three things were a huge liability when I was a participant in somebody else's company with an existing team. And so over-reliance on what you think your superpowers are can sometimes be pretty dangerous for that. And you said earlier, what if the team is getting along great and not shipping? I can promise you, as soon as you start holding them accountable for shipping, that magical getting along is going to disappear on you. So you're going to have to deal with interpersonal issues. And then the other side is it's about what you do and don't tolerate as a manager once you do understand some things.
I mean, there's always issues, right? There's always issues, but... by and large, most of the teams that I've joined have been shipping software on a regular basis, and the personality conflicts, I mean, there have been some, but they've been on the milder end of things. And the tool that I probably use the most often to change teams is just to call out the things that I'm happy to see, the things that the team is doing well and I want to see more of. And it's sort of like fertilizing a lawn, right? If you fertilize a lawn, one of the theories is that the grass will grow thick and solid and start to choke out the weeds. And I think you can do the same thing with an engineering team as you approach those peak levels of performance. Now, it won't work if everything's dysfunctional and nothing's happening.
I actually really wholeheartedly endorse that as well. If the problem is with a few people, you can surround those people in like a hug circle and just hug them until they cry. You just whisper, it's not your fault. It's not your fault.
So I've actually seen this play out in the open source community. It has to be five or more years ago. I randomly was given access to merge commits into an open source project that I had opened a handful of pull requests. It was like, and the maintainer was like, hey, have fun, and kind of went on vacation. And I was the only one merging commits at that point in time. Nobody else had admin other than the maintainer who had sort of just peaced out. And I made a conscious effort to be very welcoming and open to new contributions, regardless of whether or not we actually ended up accepting them or not, and trying to find the good in every single contribution that was made. And I did this for a year or two pretty actively, got a couple more people onboarded as maintainers, and then had to step away. My job and life situation meant I wasn't contributing to open source as much as I had in the past. And from time to time, I jump back in and just like review some of the pull requests and things like that. And I'm still seeing negative pull requests open with the, hey, thanks for contributing this. This is really awesome. Can we tweak these things? And like trying to be positive and affirming to the contribution that's there and looking for the good in it, instead of having that stereotypical Linux kernel mentality of, oh my God, this is ridiculous. Are you a crazy idiot? Who would do this? And having that be the intro. This was just one person on one open source project. And I think if you're doing that as a manager with a team and able to do that with a much tighter feedback loop than once or twice a week, you can really start to see those positive effects accrue really well. And definitely not have to spend 2 years working on a team to get it to the point that it's functioning well.
Now, the one thing that won't do is it won't bail you out of having hard conversations. And Brandon, you hinted at this about what we shouldn't put up with as managers, what we can and cannot tolerate. I'm curious what you wanted to bring up about that.
So I do just first want to say, I think the majority of the time you're going to find yourself in situations where your best bet is to use positive reinforcement primarily. And I've seen this in leadership that I've met that is way more experienced than I am. And I've seen this demonstrated in ways that I find kind of inspiring. And so I want to echo that and make sure that that's first and foremost the recommendation here. What I'm talking about is when you have severe problems of cross-team or intra-team trust, where you have like severe divisive behavior or dysfunctional behavior, or the entire machinery of shipping software has seized up. And I do not know why, and this must be something in my personality, why this was a repeated theme for me in my first few years as a manager, that I kept showing up to teams and the entire machinery had seized up. And they're like, oh, thank goodness you're here. The machinery has seized. And the people, all they do, they don't ship software. All they do is fight over code quality. And that tells me instantly, when people are arguing over nitpicky details, I know accountability has flown out the window and everybody's making up their own rules about what a software developer is supposed to do and what a good one does and what a bad one doesn't do. And there's no unifying theme of what we're collectively here to do. And then there's suddenly a baseline assumption of we're not all on the same team. We're not all pulling in the same direction, and these other people aren't trying to make something good happen, only I am. And so when I talk about what is and isn't tolerated, it's that kind of behavior where there's a pretty bright line across which you don't go. There are certain behaviors that you have to box out. You can be permissive and use positive reinforcement about almost everything, but there are certain things that are sort of basically cancerous to a team. Divisive behavior around making a base assumption that other people on the team are not on your same team. Making an assumption that other teams are, you know, not working toward the same goals you are. So I would say that falls into a very small category of things that you just sort of have to box out. And so in severe forms of team turnaround, I've had to kind of outline the behaviors that are boxed out at the same time that I'm talking about the behaviors that are rewarded.
So Brandon used the turn of phrase box out quite a bit when you were talking a second ago. And I'm familiar with the term from a basketball sense. What does that look like in practical terms on an engineering team? How do you box out a toxic behavior?
I don't remember where I stole this from, but it predates my days as a manager, where boxing out is a pattern where you draw a box around a set of behaviors and say, this is not to be tolerated. And so I guess when I say box out, I'm thinking like just compartmentalizing forms of behavior. Like there's that game where you have to draw a box and then you color it in. And so I mean box out in like literally in my mind, I'm drawing a box around toxic behaviors and saying, okay, that falls into this category and I'm going to clarify that with you. And so on an individual one-to-one basis, and I think individual coaching stuff we can get into later, that's almost a different topic. But when I'm trying to affect some kind of cultural change, I have to clarify where that line is for people. And it starts by saying, this is where the line is, and this is where I'm seeing you cross it, and these are the behaviors that I cannot tolerate. I'm on your side and I'm on your team, but I can't tolerate the behavior that causes people to not think they're on the same team. And that's always an extremely hard conversation because they're like, am I getting fired? What's going on? And it's like, no, you're not fired. I'm just telling you where the behavioral lines are. And then in the next conversation, I get to say, okay, now we've had the hard conversation. From here on, it's just coaching. It's just helping you kind of recognize and feel that out because you don't want to cross that line. I assume you want good things for this team. So now we get to talk about how to positively reinforce and coach and have gentler reminders about how to stay in bounds.
That's amazing. One of my favorite preschool teachers that my daughters had used to talk about in behaviors and out behaviors to the point that if you were on your way to being in trouble and getting in a timeout, she would get down on the kid's level and very calmly and gently ask, sweetheart, is that an in behavior or an out behavior? And 9 times out of 10, that was enough to correct it.
Wow. No kidding. All right. Maybe we should spend more time as managers training with pre-K educators. And that's not a dig.
It's not. Like, it's not a dig at all.
It's just, there's just so much in that field that is applicable and yet totally understudied in the management field.
I totally had a CEO tell me once that she wished her head of engineering would have kids solely so that he could understand that he couldn't control everything. Having kids is a very good primer for managing people, especially as an engineer, because as an engineer, like, things are nice and neat. You mentioned earlier that one of the biggest problems you can have as a new engineering manager coming from an engineering background is to treat it like, okay, I'm replacing my Ruby or my Python with developers. But for me, this is one of the things that very early on, the very first job I had that didn't have developer or senior developer or architect in the title, I went to a conference a few months later and a buddy of mine was like, hey, so how does it feel to be a manager now? And thinking through that, the answer to that question, I realized that from my mindset, it's very similar what you're trying to do. It's just the medium is entirely different. I'm very much a systems thinker when it comes to programming. Like, I like thinking about the system as a whole and how all the pieces fit together, I think is maybe one of the reasons I was always drawn to the DevOps culture. But as a manager, I've always looked at the teams as a cohesive whole. How am I trying to like get all these pieces to work together? But people are infinitely more interesting than code.
Absolutely.
If code doesn't do what I tell it to do, it's because I didn't tell it what to do correctly. And if a team doesn't do what you expected it to do, there's an infinite number of possibilities that are things that could have changed or could have affected that outcome. And the vast majority of them are not in your control. That would be an action item I would give to anybody listening to this that's on the fence. Do I want to be a manager? Do I not want to be a manager? Are you okay ceding some of that control and looking at the team as that system? And if you're not okay with that, you might want to think really hard about whether or not management is the right career move for you. And if anybody out there is listening to this and thinking I just took a personal dig at them, I'm not. Just looking out for you here.
No, and they're probably not listening. The person that I'm, the funny thing is, I literally met a manager once and I asked him, because I got the sense in this that he wasn't really interested in this craft and he was really only interested in the deep technical architectural problems of the world. And I'm like, what is it that drove you to want to become a manager? And he said, control. I wanted more control. And I'm like, oh man, this is literally the opposite of the profession that's going to give you that. And then he returned to architecture shortly thereafter. So I think everybody won.
So I've disqualified candidates for architect roles actually for exactly that. So why are you wanting to get into a role that's a little bit more of a leadership role? Oh, I want to be able to control things. Why? Oh, well, I've seen all these bad decisions made before. And if I could have made them, they would have been right. Like, okay. So we got 30 minutes to kill here.
There's one other thing I want to talk about when you're joining a new team. And let's say the machinery has seized or is not working as well as you want it to. And you do have sort of carte blanche where somebody says, just help us learn to ship. We don't know how to ship. We do like each other. We just don't know how to ship. And in addition to your information gathering and research, your job is not to get the team to ship. Your job is to get the team excited to ship. And I've done everything from throwing out the electronic tools that they don't like using and moving straight to index cards, or, hey, we're going to start changing some stuff based on the recommendations we're getting from people. We proved to you that we did the homework. Here's the feedback that I got. Based on that feedback, this looks like the top problems that we need to solve as a team. Problem one is blah, blah, blah with shipping. The reason that people feel like that's not going as well as it could be is because of this. So we're going to tackle this. But it's almost more about throwing away the pre-existing context and the frame of thinking where people were entrenched in some way of doing things that they felt like they couldn't control, and showing them they can take control. If you're a software engineer, software is not a thing that happens to you. The software development process is not a thing that happens to you. You are the thing that happens to the software. And I think usually when you see a team that is in need of some kind of repair, they've forgotten that somehow. They've been beaten down by bad process, or something happened where they lost the plot because they all got into this industry for some reason. And this is pretty cool stuff. This is a hard job, but it's pretty cool. And people can forget that. And you can help restart their enthusiasm and excitement for it. It could be literally as simple as changing one process, as long as that comes from feedback that you actually gathered from the team and reflect back to them.
I think you hit the nail on the head right there. You're focusing on one process. So often you're looking at the outcome, and the outcome is, oh, we've got to ship software every 2 weeks at the end of our sprint, or we've got to have our app hit the app store on this monthly cadence. Whatever the metric is that you're looking at as the goal, there's a tendency to want to focus on that goal. And goals can be really clarifying and help you understand where you're going. But a book that I recently listened to that I really, really enjoyed, Atomic Habits, the author talks about using goals as a clarifying tool and then throwing them out and focus 100% on the process. And I've seen this play out in software development, in management, in athletics. I have been a triathlete at certain points in my life, in that I have competed in triathlons and done some of the longer distance ones. I 100% love racing. Of just about any stripe, but triathlons are a really fun race. I hate the process. So I am no longer a triathlete because I do not like the process. I love the goal. I love thinking about racing. I love racing, the actual act of doing it, but the act of training for three different sports at the same time, that process just wears me down. But I have other things I would like to do with my life than focus on that. And I think that that's the key thing for somebody coming into a team and trying to figure out how to move it in the right direction. Figure out the goal where you're headed, then figure out the process that's going to get you to that goal, and then throw away the goal. Just forget about it. At that point, it doesn't matter. Focus on the process. This is one thing. So as a developer, I used to hate whenever I would hear the S word. As soon as someone brought out Scrum, I was like, my eyes were rolling back in my head, and I was like, oh, great, one of those. As somebody who's always trying to falsify their own beliefs, I've gone back and read some of the quote unquote source material on Scrum. And when you actually focus on some of the original doctrine out of Scrum, it's amazing. The whole thing is a framework for creating a process that works for you. And it's like, here's some guardrails. You're going to throw them away at some point because you're not going to need them, and you're going to figure out what works for you. But here's a process that you can follow that is going to give you the process of building and shipping software, or whatever process you're applying and building whatever you're trying to apply it to. It's going to give you something that's customized to you. But Scrum at its core is something that's turned inward to focus on the process.
And I think that's interesting. We brought up the analogy of throwing out Jira for something else. And I think there's a reason that that's one of the things we point to, because a lot of times when you come into an engineering team where the works have seized up, where nothing is working, where they can't ship software, a lot of what's going on is they've had so much process that has accreted over time to try to fix this problem of shipping software that all they do is feed the process. That's literally all they can accomplish as a team. And by the time that they have fulfilled their responsibilities to the process, they don't have any energy left to ship software. And so that's why this step often works.
Yeah, to call back to an episode a few back in our list, a lot of teams get really good at estimating. But being good at estimating and being good at doing the work as a team is a totally different thing.
Once you feel like you've got the license to do this, I see a lot of people that take over teams make one of their first points of order to strip away all of the process and then rebuild only back the parts of the process that are necessary to function.
Yep, I tend to tell teams when fairly early in my tenure that I'm there to help cultivate the process, But ultimately, the process is theirs. And my job as a manager is to help them discover the process that works for them to ship software. I'm not there to impose anything on them.
Yes, that's your code base. That's your process. It is your work. You are in charge of making your work work for you. The job is already hard enough. You have to be an expert at so much. And you have intense pressure to deliver business value. So if I can just expose the business value to you and give you a starter kit or the mechanism to provide your own starter kit, you ought to be able to modify this to suit your own needs. Giving that power back to the people who actually do the work is your best bet for getting that result. And so when things seize up, something has gone haywire systemically. And I think that's what I want to come back to is you find the systemic thing.
And a lot of situations where teams have learned helplessness around it.
Oh, man. That's a concept that we need to unpack in a different episode. The idea of learned helplessness on teams is definitely a common trope.
So to summarize the conversation that we've had, we've talked about a lot of different aspects of taking over or inheriting a new team. That was the original conversation. So what pieces of advice would you give to a developer, Nick, who found themselves in this situation?
My first piece of advice circles back right to the start of the episode. Slow your roll. Just take your time understanding the team. I mean, there's risks to that. You don't want to take it too far, but especially if this is your first or maybe even your second management gig, take your time to get the lay of the land. Don't feel pressure to get a lot done in a hurry until you understand the team that you have found yourself in. I think another thing to call out is that learned helplessness often comes from leaders who feel like they have more control than they actually do over a software engineering team. So the other thing I would call out is make sure you understand before you make this decision in your career how much control you actually don't have in a management position. It's nothing like writing code. We talked about it earlier in the episode, but I want to call it back out because this is how software teams get into a disempowered, learned helpless state is from management and leadership who tries to exert more control over a team than they possibly could.
What about you, Travis? What advice would you give?
I would build on what both of y'all have said. I have definitely fought against that internal desire to show results quickly and almost feed into that imposter syndrome to say, hey, look, I'm supposed to be here. Look at all the things that I've done. I've also tried to figure out ways to get teams excited about work where I've seen them doing awesome things and not being excited about it, where it's just like, oh yeah, this is just what we do. And like, well, this is amazing. Like, be excited about it. The thing I would offer to someone stepping into this role early on is to remember that you are in that position. Hopefully you're in that position because you have the talent to do what it is that you've been brought in to do. And don't second guess that too much. It's always healthy to check yourself as you are trying to make decisions, ensure that you are making decisions for the right reason. But remember, you were brought into this room for a reason, and don't be afraid of staking those claims and saying, oh yeah, this is a direction we need to move in. You'll know when that's the right decision. There is a little bit of an art to that. It'll take some trial and error to get it exactly right. I'm 7-8 years into leadership roles, and I'm still working out exactly when that perfectly right position is, but don't be too reserved.
What about you, Brandon?
If I could give one piece of advice to somebody taking over a new team, it piggybacks on your answer, Nick, but I really would put a concerted focus on fierce, active listening, including inquiring and reflecting. Gather the data. I'm not usually a data person. I'm a feeling person, but I have learned there are situations where you've got to do your homework. And when you're coming into a new role, you've got to do a lot of homework. So when you say slow your roll, I know that's what you mean, is gather information, do your homework, and then take that, really listen and demonstrate that you're listening by reflecting that back to the team and letting them know, here is what I've learned. Here's what I understand about the team. Here's where am I correct in understanding these are the problems facing the team. Okay. So if we started tackling some of these, that'd be good. Okay. Then you don't have to hit a very high bar. You just have to be tackling the thing that feels most painful to the team overall. And I think you don't have to prove, like to your point, Travis, you don't have to prove your value. You don't have to prove anything. You just have to come in and start fixing things and start making things better. And the proof will emerge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's probably a good place to end on. So for everybody listening, thank you for joining us for this episode of Managing Up. I'm Brandon Hayes. You can find me at TeeHViking on Twitter. That's T-E-H Viking.
I'm Nick Means. You can find me at NMeans on Twitter.
And I'm Travis Weisgood, and you can find me at TSweisgood just about everywhere.
And if you like the show, the best way you can help us is to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, or tell your friends about it. And if you have any questions, thoughts, or suggestions, like the one we got today, you can tweet at us at Managing Up Show. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great week, and we'll see you again soon.